Welcome to Weight Loss And, where we delve into the world of weight loss. I'm Jim Hill.
And I'm Holly Wyatt. We're both dedicated to helping you lose weight, keep it off, and living your best life while you're doing it.
Indeed, we now realize successful weight loss combines the science and art of medicine, knowing what to do and why you will do it.
Yes, the and allows us to talk about all the other stuff that makes your journey so much bigger, better, and exciting.
Ready for the and factor?
Let's dive in.
Here we go. Welcome to another episode of Weight Loss And. I'm Jim Hill, along with Holly Wyatt. Holly, today we're going to talk about the sweetness of life.
What do you mean by that? The sweetness of life. All right, Jim, you have to tell us more about that.
I'm talking about the fact that we like sweet things. And here's the deal. We don't learn to like sweet things. I remember when I was in college, I saw this video of little babies. You give them something sweet and they smile and they light up. So we're born loving this sweet taste. And again, in my opinion, life wouldn't be as great without sweet things.
I think it's a little of both. And this will be a great question. I think we're wired and perhaps we learn a little bit about it too. So yeah, that'll be a good question.
But like anything else, Holly, you can overdo it. So a lot of advice right now is to reduce sugar in your diet. Sugar's a source of sweetness. And I don't know why we can't get nutrition advice to avoid cauliflower. I mean, man, I could follow that one. But, you know, right now, most of the experts are saying you're taking in too much sugar. Those calories are causing problems in weight gain and other negative metabolic effects. So we're asked to reduce something that we really like, and that's tough. And a lot of the people that are losing weight really have a lot of questions about reducing sugar, what's the alternative, etc. So to help us wade through all this, we have a guest today. One of the fun things, Holly, on this podcast is we can bring in the researchers that we really admire and we really like.
Yes, and the tough questions. I'm like, when it's a tough question, let's bring in somebody else to help answer it.
Yeah, exactly. So our guest today is Dr. John Sievenpiper. He's from our neighboring country up north, Canada. He's the associate professor and Department of Nutrition Sciences at the University of Toronto. I visited him once in Toronto, and I think it's the coldest I've ever been in my life. Toronto is a wonderful city, but maybe go in the spring or summer. So, John, welcome to Weight Loss And.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
So before we dive into this issue, tell people about the kind of research that you and your research group at University of Toronto engage in.
Yeah, no, thanks for asking. So we're interested, my research program is really focused on using, in terms of tools, we use randomized controlled trials and epidemiological tools, looking at large databases, like looking at collections or syntheses of the available evidence, or also looking at data sets like NHANES or large prospective cohorts and doing analyses in those. So those are the basic tools we use to answer our questions. The questions really relate to those that are really pressing in terms of clinical and public health importance around areas of carbohydrate quality as it relates to sugars and sweeteners, which we're going to talk about today, and in particular, traditional and therapeutic dietary patterns. So that's kind of the interest in terms of the nutrition. And then the outcomes we're interested in are relate to obesity, diabetes, and their downstream, if you like, cardiometabolic complications like cardiovascular disease.
Ah, so you're looking at large data sets, what people eat, and sort of health outcomes.
Exactly right.
Great.
So are we ready to go with the questions, Jim?
Let's hit him with the hard questions, Holly.
I think I'm going to start right off by, you know, John, I think that a lot of people trying to manage their weight are confused about low-calorie sweeteners. And I want you at some point to kind of define low-calorie sweeteners versus non-nutritive sweeteners, make sure we're on the same page there. You know, even I, again, I get confused. And on one hand, our listeners are being told to avoid sugar. On the other hand, some experts are advising them not to consume products that have low-calorie sweeteners, products that would substitute these low-calorie sweeteners for the sugar. And I think it's especially true with beverages. And on paper, I understand that it looks good to say, you know, drink water. I mean, that's not a bad thing to say, but let's get real. I would like to be able to have some sweetened beverages sometimes and some foods that have some sweetness. I don't really want to go the rest of my life with never tasting something that is sweet. So what does your research say about these low-calorie sweeteners and body weight regulation, weight loss, et cetera?
So, yeah, no, great question, a big question. So, I mean, the first thing I think maybe is to talk a little bit about what sweeteners are. So they are alternative sweeteners that are alternatives to sugars. So in general, these are no or low calorie options for consumers. The ones that we're most probably familiar with would be ones like aspartame or ACE-K or sucralose that would sweeten beverages and some foods. Beverage is the most common format that we find are sweeteners.
Splenda and Equal and Sweet and Low are the brands.
Yeah, exactly. In terms of brands, what you'd see in terms of packets. But if you were to read the label of a can of your favorite diet beverage, it would probably be ACE-K or sucralose or aspartame. These are considered high-intensity sweeteners because they have a much higher sweetness than sugars. So it's milligram amounts of these are needed to replace gram amounts. And if you take an example like Aventame or Neotame, you would need, John Fernstrom, colleague and friend, would say you need molecular forceps to sweeten your coffee. You need very little amount.
These things are powerful. They're so sweet.
Ooh, I like that picture just a tiny bit. Wow.
Yeah, and that's important when we talk about how we use them in different food systems and food, you know, matrices. But in terms of beverages, which is the most common, this is where we've really looked at the question. And I think that this is an important, if you like, matrix or food source to look at, because it's really sugar sweetened beverages which have driven the evidence to reduce sugars that Jim was talking about. Our guidelines recommendations to reduce sugars in the diet and calories from sugars really comes from data from sugar-sweetened beverages where they tend to be over-consumed. So if we look at that specific food matrix, and it's important, I think, to look at different matrices, when we look at sugar-sweetened beverages and replacing those with low and no-calorie sweetened beverages or our favorite diet beverages, if you like, we look at that evidence. We look at the randomized controlled trial evidence, and Jim has certainly contributed to this with a really important trial. But when we look at those trials, we actually see a very consistent signal where we see a reduction in weight, reduction in body fat and liver fat in particular. When we look at that, what we like to call an intended substitution, that's where the consumer, those listening, you know, when we're making our choices, we're looking to reduce sugars, reduce calories, we're taking the diet option. That intended substitution, we see weight loss.
So for weight, you're better off doing the non-calorie sweeteners or low-calorie sweeteners than sugar itself.
Exactly right. And when we set it up, we did a synthesis to inform the update of the European guidelines, the European Association for the Study of Diabetes. And we found really what other guidelines had found. But in particular, when we did our evidence synthesis for that guideline, which we published in JAMA Network Open in early 2022, what we found was that we set it up, we looked at the substitution of low and no calorie for sugar-sweetened beverages, but we also wanted to look at water because that's the standard of care. We're being told to drink water, and I think we should be recommending water. So we want to understand what that would look like, standard of care, and then how it would compare to water. And what we actually found is that it compares very, very well to water. We found very similar reductions. So our conclusion was really as an alternative to sugars, it behaves very similarly to water in terms of the weight loss benefit you might expect from displacing those calories.
So I love this. So you could drink water and get the effect, or you could use a non or low sugar kind of beverage substituted for the sugar and get the same impact in terms of that, your research.
Yeah, exactly. And we looked across actually 20 different intermediate cardiometabolic outcomes, and we found really a very similar signal across all of those. In particular, where the benefit seems to be is in terms of displacing calories. And then with that displacement of calories, less calories, we see a reduction in weight and adiposity, and very similar to what we would see with water. So we were quite confident in our conclusion for those guidelines, and others have echoed that in their guidelines, that really that yes, the standard of care is water, and this is a reasonable alternative to water to get the benefit of displacing those excess calories from sugars.
You know, Holly, you and I have worked over the years with the National Weight Control Registry, and we ask a lot of questions about sugar and non-caloric sweetener use there, John. One of the things these people tell us is they get no calories from beverages. They're basically saying, I want my calories from food, not beverages. And they tell us exactly what you said. They said, you know, most of the time we drink water, but we like something sweet every now and then. So we're fine to use the non-caloric sweeteners. So what you find in a research study really fits with real life of people that are keeping their weight off.
Which is terrific. And I think that's important. And what gets missed a lot is, you know, when we talk about, I'm involved with clinical practice guidelines development for obesity, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease. And the big push really right now is values, preferences, and treatment goals. So we have a lot of evidence for different approaches to improve diet, to improve risk factors. But there isn't necessarily one best way of doing it. There are a number of ways. So then it comes down to values, preferences, and treatment goals and meeting people where they're at. And so if someone wants sweetness and likes sweetness, then this is a good alternative.
Oh, this is great, because we talk a lot about that, John. Is you know, so much in the media, you hear there's one way to do it. You got to do one thing. And what we say over and over is you have options. If water is fine with you, there's no problem. Drink water. You're great. But if you like something sweet, there are alternatives. And one of the things that we often talk about is if you look at the number of things that probably relate to weight gain, this is not a short list. This is a long list. And there are different sorts of things you need to worry about. And that's where I love this idea of its preference and its options. And we try to show people options. And this is a great one. You can drink water or you can use some low-calorie sweeteners.
Yeah, and it's really this whole point about the and. This is really what this podcast is, weight loss and, is that it doesn't have to be one. There's multiple. And so it fits really, really nicely. But why do you think that there are experts in the field who continue to fiercely oppose the use of these low-calorie sweeteners?
That's a tough one. It's hard to read minds. I do have a sense of it, as I'm sure both you and Jim do. You know, I think part of it is this sense that they're artificial. I mean, there's this distinction between artificial and natural, and we do have some natural, you know, stevia or others, some what's called natural sweeteners or monk fruit versus the others. But in general, these are considered artificial. And so there's that whole anti-artificial, anti-sort of synthetic compounds, you know, bias that I think people have. If it's natural, it's good. If it's artificial, it's bad. It's not very scientific. It's just it's sort of appealing to base emotions. People also, I think, are against things that taste good and worry that they may contribute to overconsumption. So, you know, there's this concern about sweetness. And these, although they don't come with calories and they do displace calories from sugars, you know, is the sweetness the problem? Our diet is too sweet and this is contributing to too much sweetness, and that this may lead to overconsumption and may lead to some downstream knock-on adverse effects. So I think there's a lot. And then, you know, I think a lot of it too, it's because it's tied to big food and big food industry, because these are manufactured and produced and put into manufactured foods, you know, packaged foods. I think, you know, it's also sort of tied into that ultra processed food concern about ultra processed foods, that these are a marker of that. So I think there's a number of different ways you can approach why people are concerned. But I think those are a few different, you know, ways that I think people come to that conclusion.
One of the things we often tell our listeners, John, is that all research doesn't come up to the same conclusions. There are really research studies that come up with different conclusions. And as you know, there are studies out there that show some negative effects of these. One of the things that I see oftentimes that worries me a little bit is a lot of those studies use exceptionally high doses of these things. So can you overdo it? Can you consume too much of this, you think?
So these compounds are regulated as food additives in the US and in most jurisdictions in Canada by Health Canada, or in Europe by the European Food Safety Authority. And so as food additives, what's actually set for them in the case of sweeteners is this acceptable daily intake. So at what level do we see no harm, up to which point? And that's, you know, done very, you know, through, we could have a whole podcast on how the FDA or Health Canada, these different authorities, JECFA and so on, do their assessments and the standards. But needless to say, it's very comprehensive. Sweeteners, in fact, aspartame represents, if not the, one of the most studied food ingredients in the history, certainly of the FDA and these different organizations. So very, very well-studied from animal up to human studies. And they apply a big safety factor in going from species to species, a tenfold, and then even with the variety that we have within species, another 10. So a 100-fold safety factor to set these what they call ADIs, acceptable daily intakes. So we do have these for sweeteners. Now, to achieve these, I mean, would require heroic measures. Like you would need to have, you know, an incredible number of beverages, like 20 or 30, depending on the sweetener, or more per day, like levels, you know, which people almost physically cannot consume. So we are well within the ADIs in terms certainly of normal intake. And even people that are very, very large or super consumers of these, if you like, they're not even getting close to the ADI. So yes, you can overdo it. That's why we have an ADI, but the ADI is, the bar is set so high that really within the food supply and the way people these are consumed, we're not even close to it.
So my wife consuming two or three diet sodas a day is not reason for concern.
Absolutely not reason for concern. No.
She'll be very relieved, John, that I will tell her you said that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just wanted to make the point that something that you mentioned, there's individual studies that may say one thing and another, and that leads to the confusion because then the media will present the results from the one study and then the next day or the next week, the results from the next. And then the consumer's like, well, what's the answer here? When we look at this for the purpose of guidelines, like we did for the update of the European guidelines, these organizations look at it for the development of their guidelines. What we do is we look at the totality of the evidence. So we synthesize all of the available evidence on this question and the highest level evidence. So when we look at randomized controlled trials, which represents the best evidence that we have, because it gives us the best protection against bias, that's when we come to the answers that I provided. And we talk about comparing a low or substituting a low and no calorie sweetened beverage, let's say for a sugar sweetened beverage or water. When we did that, we were looking at the totality of the evidence. So it wasn't cherry picking an individual study or looking at one study. It's taking all of the studies that have looked at this question and synthesizing them to come to that conclusion.
That's so important what you said, so important, because oftentimes you see in the newspaper headlines the result of one study and you want to say, based on this study, you should go and do this. But that's not how science works. Science works with recognizing that if we do 10 studies, not every result's going to be the same. And we have to sort out sort of the overall gestalt of that. And along those lines, can you tell people what meta-analysis is?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, meta, the term meta sort of means around, and a meta-analysis is sort of an analysis of all, you know, of all the studies. So a meta-analysis is taking individual studies, which are the unit of the analysis, if you like, putting them all together and doing this meta or overall, if you like, or pooled analysis of all the available data. So it's not just saying, oh, this paper concluded that, and that paper concluded that, and do a vote counting approach, as it were, like, oh, I got 10 to 1 saying it's a good thing or 10 to 1 saying it's a bad thing. It's no, we're going to take all the studies, put them together and analyze the data, not the conclusions, the data, and synthesize it to come to a conclusion where each one is weighted based on the how large and important the study is.
Well, that's why I think these guidelines are so important for people to recognize that it's the experts getting together, it's looking at the data in its totality, and then it's trying to translate that into, based on the science we know today, and that could change tomorrow, but based on the science we know today, here are some recommendations for you.
Yeah, it takes it all and uses it all to help come up with a conclusion, which is really what I think we're wanting. You know, we can't take the consumer and our listeners, take these individual studies. We don't know what to do with them. But that's a method to come up with something that uses everything that's out there.
Yeah. And I think where nutrition is different, let's say, than pharmaceuticals, you don't feel like you're seeing every week in the news, you know, a pharmaceutical study contradicting another one in terms of a medication that's gone through a very, very of large development, is that when we study pharmaceuticals, these are extremely large trials, you know, thousands of patients. So you get like a drug that I prescribe or use, like a PCSK9 inhibitor, you know, the trial is almost 28,000 individuals. So massive trials followed for years. In nutrition, we tend to have much smaller trials, maybe it's 20 or 30, some of the larger studies up to 100 or a couple hundred, and it's on intermediate biomarkers. But because they're smaller, it means we can get differing results from study to study. So we have what we call a bit of a power gap, if you like, in terms of the power of these studies to actually come to a definitive conclusion. So in nutrition in particular, we really need meta-analyses because we have all these smaller, we would call sort of underpowered or less powered studies. And by putting them together, we can actually increase the information size, improve the precision of the estimates to get a truer estimate of the real or true effect. So really important in nutrition. And it sort of sorts through then that sort of media storm that we have of one study saying one thing one week and one study saying something else the next week when we're looking at individual studies.
So along that lines, Jim, I think this fits really well, and it's from a listener at this point. So, you know, you are kind of putting together all these low calorie sweeteners. Do you think there is a difference between something like aspartame and monk fruit? And should we be studying those separately? And I think that is some of the confusion too. Of all the low calorie sweeteners, are there differences? And is there one group that perhaps is better or I should be considering?
Yeah, this is an important question. So I think it has to be understood from the safety standpoint. So assessing the safety of these ingredients in the food supply, they're assessed individually. And all of the ones that are approved have been approved based on individual data on the individual sweeteners. So in terms of safety, and I think that's important to understand, are these molecules, because they're a very heterogeneous group, a very different set of molecules that all have this property of sweet taste and being able to transmit through the sweet taste receptor. So that's that. But when we look at the data in terms of, so assuming then they're safe and knowing that they're safe based on those assessments, that when we look at it from a health, like a public health or a clinical perspective, we're looking at it really as a tool, like a single class of components or ingredients that can displace calories. That's really their intended use, right? To displace sugars and calories. So now we're looking at them as a class. And here we have much less data of individual sweeteners that we can actually do head to head. Now, we've done it on acute studies. These are shorter term single bolus studies where you feed sweeteners, where they have looked at individual sweeteners. We did something called the network meta-analysis. You can create a league table. We don't really see that any sweetener is any better than another in terms of where they're displacing excess calories from sugars. They all seem to do the job as advertised. If we're actually looking, though, at the data that we do have from the trials and even from the observational studies, which we should talk about and we'll talk about, you could talk about, well, which sweetener has been studied the most? And I would say most of the studies have been on those sweeteners that are most common in the marketplace. So it's going to be what you're going to find, the most prevalent sweeteners will be like aspartame and acesulfame potassium or ACE-K and sucralose. So most of the research there is of those. The other thing to be said there too is that most sweeteners do not appear alone in foods. So you may have it in a pack alone, but when you're having your food, it actually blends. So even you could argue like looking at individual sweeteners isn't going to help you to understand what's happening in my diet beverage, where it's going to be a blend of aspartame and ACE-K or maybe all three with sucralose. And they're doing that to get at the sensory properties to really elicit a sweet taste that's the most similar to sugars so that the consumer is sort of happiest with the beverage, if you like. So a lot of that is being done just from the perspective of achieving the best sensory profile.
And again, I want to emphasize back to the safety. I really want to put a plug in for these food regulatory agencies, the FDA, the Canadian regulatory group. They look at tons of studies around the safety of these things. Our food supply in the US and Canada is incredibly safe because these organizations go out and look at the totality of the data. So I want to emphasize again, they all seem to do the job, but they've all been considered safe by the FDA and the Canadian.
Yeah, I mean, and it goes even further, even European Food Safety Authority, and then the world sort of regulatory group, JECFA, which is under the WHO umbrella. So all have reviewed these and looked at these sweeteners. And so what the FDA approves has been recognized by all of these jurisdictions. So you can be very confident that these are safe.
And I love that they've been studied independently for the safety aspect. I think that is something that is a message the consumers need to understand, that each and every one of them have been looked at as individual molecules. So that I think is important. All right, I'm going to switch gears a little bit because here's the other question that came from our listener. And it's one I get all the time and I can't wait to hear your answer. So maybe, you know, when you have a non-caloric beverage with a non-caloric sweetener in it, what happens to insulin? Is insulin remain flat? Does it go up? You know, there's with the low carb diets and so much, lots of talk about insulin and what impact it may have. And with, you know, some of the new medications and everything, there's a big interest in hormones and insulin. And so when you have something with no calories, but a low calorie sweetener or non-calorie sweetener in it, does insulin spike?
This is a great question. And this is a big one because a lot of the concern comes from sort of it's putting the mechanism before the clinical phenomena. As I like to say, it's kind of a you know, it's a mechanism in search of a clinical effect. you know, trying to understand what's going on. So the short answer is no. But what I want to spend a little time just to so the listeners understand the level of evidence we have here. So we put together something called a network meta-analysis, and that's like a super meta-analysis because it looks at all the pairwise comparisons of where we compared a sweetener to a sugar, a sweetener to water, a sweetener to a sweetener, but then all the indirects as well, where we have a common comparator to really increase the information size. So when we look at that and we're able to create, I mentioned this before, like a league table and really look at how these individual sweeteners, sweetener blends, how water behaves and how caloric sugars like glucose, sucrose, and fructose behave. When we actually look at those and we look at not just insulin, but other important metabolic and endocrine responses related to carbohydrate metabolism, the handling of glucose, but also food intake regulation, because a lot of it's the thought is, oh, maybe this uncoupling of sweetness and calories may lead to one consuming more. And we look at that and we look at not just insulin, but we look at other hormones like GLP-1 and GIP. These are incretin or gut hormones that are related to food intake regulation and related to the handling of glucose. We look at things like ghrelin and PYY. So these are really the main sort of hormones, if you like. And we look at also glucose, like does it elicit a glucose response in terms of a metabolic effect? We don't see any effects across any of those for any of the sweeteners. And so I think we can be really confident that no. And we looked at it in three different ways, importantly here too, because one is, well, some people say, well, it's the uncoupling of sweetness and calories. Maybe when you're taking it as a refreshment or as a hydration beverage. And others say, no, it's when you take it with a meal. It's when you take it with other, you know, carbohydrates or fats or proteins in a mixed meal format. That's where sweeteners have their problem, which we call the coupling hypothesis or uncoupling. Whether it's coupled or uncoupled from food, we see no effect across postprandial glucose. It does not elicit a postprandial glycemic response, does not affect insulin or any of those hormones.
Wow, that's the beauty of being able to look at pulling data together and looking at things.
And so just follow up, though, because this is where the listener will say, so do you, your data that would also show that it doesn't increase cravings? Because some people say, you know, if I drink something that tastes sweet, even though no calories, there's good that I have no calories then. But then in an hour, 2 hours later in the day, my cravings come back for a sweetened for sugar or for, you know, wanting more. Is there something, anything in your data that can help with that?
Yeah. So this question's been looked at too. I don't know that it's been looked at as carefully, but they've certainly put it into trials where you can put like craving inventories and different things. We don't see that. But I would say more importantly than cravings, what would matter to me is, does it lead to me compensating and eating more calories? And then beyond that, even more important to me, does it lead to me gaining weight? So more calories, more weight. And more importantly to me as a doctor would be, does that weight translate to downstream bad things like diabetes or things like that? So when we look at that question, the answer is no. And in fact, they do work as you would expect. So if you're using it to displace calories from sugars, we actually see it decreases overall energy intake without a complete compensation. It decreases weight. And it decreases some of the risk factors for those downstream. So overall, the answer is really no. We don't see that it's increasing cravings or leading to an increase in energy intake later, let's say in the day or tomorrow, that may lead to weight gain and some of the downstream bad effects of having too much weight.
Okay, Holly, you know what it's time for.
Yes, Jim, go for it. Yes, the vulnerability question, John. You have to get vulnerable. We asked something that maybe you don't want to share, but...
But you have to anyway. So John, do you consume low-calorie sweeteners?
Like your wife, Jim, it sounds like, enjoys to have a diet beverage. And so she often has it in the fridge. And so I'll grab it. My beverage of choice tends to be sparkling water. But I do enjoy a diet beverage. A diet cola usually would be my favorite diet beverage of choice. And I would select that over a sugary or caloric beverage because... frankly, I don't want the calories, so I make that choice.
Do you have a favorite non-calorie sweetener of all the lists we've been talking about? Do you prefer one?
Yeah, I know. What I can tell you is I know which ones I don't like, and it's purely from a sensory standpoint. So, although again, that's why we get a blend. So for some reason, for me, sucralose, I get more of a metallic, and others do too. And they describe that. They can describe that with stevia and others. With a sucralose, I taste that more in a yogurt and in some beverage. So for me, it's probably aspartame, ACE-K. That combination for me works very well, purely from a sensory perspective that it, you know, for me gives me the closest sensation to sugar, the sweet taste that I prefer.
So there's those preferences coming out.
Yeah, absolutely.
You have choices. You have options.
There's lots of sweeteners on the market and lots of options. So yeah, I think you can find the one that, you know, works best for you. And they don't all work the same in a cooking prep. You know, the other thing you have to think about, their functional properties. So you can't really cook with aspartame because, you know, it breaks down. You can with sucralose. So you may like this particular sweetener. It may not have application for all the different foods you might want to consume it in.
But there are many out there, so you have choices.
You have choices.
Last vulnerability question. This is because it's an opinion. A lot of times this question falls under kind of the vulnerability because there's not necessarily a right or wrong. It's kind of your opinion about it. What do you think is the biggest misconception about low-calorie sweeteners that the public or our listeners have?
Yeah, the misconception I think that, you know, that people are getting in this narrative, you know, I think has come out of the media a lot is may contribute to weight gain. They may contribute to some of the adverse downstream complications of weight gain. So they may sabotage our best efforts. We're trying to lose weight. We're trying to reduce sugars and other sources of calories. And that these may not be able, it may not behave as advertised. It may be even have an adverse effect in terms of weight gain and some of those things. What I would say to that, and it's something I did want to get into a bit, is a lot of that's driven in nutrition. A lot of our guidelines too are driven by epidemiology, large observational studies. If you like that type of research, it has particular issues as it relates, methodological considerations as it relates to sweeteners. And the reason is it's a very high risk of something called reverse causality. So people are taking sweeteners in most cases to displace calories from sugars. And they may be doing it because they're overweight or obese, or they're at risk for obesity or at risk for diabetes or have diabetes. So they're already at higher risk to begin with, and they're taking it as a risk mitigation strategy. So when we see some of these signals that are in the media that say, oh, that sweeteners may be associated with higher weight or, you know, with more diabetes or more cardiovascular disease, these are at high risk of reverse causality. It's not that the sweeteners are causing the weight gain or causing the diabetes, the cardiovascular disease. It's that because you're at risk for those things, it's causing you to consume the sweeteners. That's the reverse causality.
Oh, that's beautiful, John. And so if you take a group of people and you say, oh, the heavier people are using more sweeteners, well, duh, right?
Yeah, no, exactly. And I want to say among like the very, you know, the serious epidemiologists, the guidelines panels, the workers, everyone is aware of that. And it's something that we did actually, we did an analysis that we published in Diabetes Care, where we did, we took an approach to the epidemiology to mitigate some of that reverse causality and some of the other we call residual confounding and some of the behavioral clustering that you get with observational studies that you don't get with randomized trials, to try to see if we could actually reconcile that, because the trials all show these signals that for benefit in terms of weight. It's the epidemiology that's got this disconnect. So we really wanted to see, can we, you know, get signals that are more biologically plausible, more consistent with the randomized trials, more reliable. And we did as we modeled change. So a lot of the epidemiology, a lot of observational studies just measure the people at the beginning, and then they follow them 10, 15, 20 years and look at the outcome. They don't actually sample diet throughout to see if there's changes in diet. They're just assuming the diet stays the same. So if you do change analyses, you actually see the opposite. You see weight loss and you see improvements, not increased risk. When we do substitution, getting at that intended substitution, again, for let's say a sugar sweetened beverage, you again, not only do not see harm, you see the complete opposite. You see weight loss, you see a reduction in cardiovascular disease, and then really big ones, reduction in the cardiovascular mortality and decreases in all-cause mortality. So we're actually seeing signals now that very much support what the randomized controlled trials show on those small or intermediate outcomes. And we now have good harmonization across these different lines of evidence, if you like. So this is an area where I think the epidemiologists are working on this, and we're trying to improve those signals, trying to sort out the reverse causality. But just know when you have individual studies reporting, again, not pooling them all together, and depending on the design, you may have some of these methodological issues, which as a researcher, we're aware of, but the public and the media isn't always aware of, and that doesn't really always come out and isn't always communicated.
Oh, Holly, I love this episode because we're not out there giving you our opinion. We're sort of telling you what the data says. And John, the thing that amazes me is how consistent the data are once you start looking at large quantities. This is fabulous. So now it's time for Pie on the Plate. So John, people out there listening, worried about managing weight, thinking about, should I consume non-caloric sweeteners or not? What's your advice?
My answer would be that based on the data, yeah, if they choose to, they can. It works very similar to water. It behaves very similar to water. And look at the data, which would be our standard of care, our standard public health advice, our standard clinical practice advice, that it is a viable option. So in terms of meeting people where they're at and their enjoyment of sweetness, they can enjoy that sensory experience of sweetness with a diet or low and no calorie sweetened beverage to replace sugar sweetened beverages and get the benefits from doing that. So yes.
Fantastic. John, thank you. This has been wonderful. It's really great to take all the science you've done and really show people that there's evidence behind the recommendations we make. So thank you so much for being part of our episode today. And we will see everybody on the next episode of Weight Loss And.
Yes, thank you so much. This is wonderful.
Thank you.
And that's a wrap for today's episode of Weight Loss And. We hope you enjoy diving into the world of weight loss with us.
If you want to stay connected and continue exploring the ands of weight loss, be sure to follow our podcast on your favorite platform.
We'd also love to hear from you. Share your thoughts, questions, or topic suggestions by reaching out at weightlossand.com. Your feedback helps us tailor future episodes to your needs.
And remember, the journey doesn't end here. Keep applying the knowledge and strategies you've learned and embrace the power of the and in your own weight loss journey.